Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, making my way back to New York City. Be back in there by Monday's program. Have a lot to share today. We're going to talk about vitamin D reducing your risk of heart attacks, especially if you're African American. Why the U.S. meat and poultry that you eat is widely contaminated with drug-resistant staph bacteria. Vegetarians are at a lower risk of heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. Calorie restriction prevents birth defects in offspring. That's something very important. And unhealthy lifestyles associated with sexual dysfunction and a lot more on health and healing. From our environmental segment today, a new law facilitates the privatization of U.S. water systems. From Carrie Barron, and we'll talk about this. So while on the one hand, we're running out of water in California and 19 other states in severe drought, there are major forces that are buying up the water rights throughout the United States, and this is particularly true in California. So when you do have access to water, you're not going to be getting it through your state or federal government. You'll be paying a private company to supply you with the water. Why should water be dealt with in this way? But it is. If you live in the Miami area, how many nuclear facilities do you have? We have two. In the northern part of the state, you have a third, and over in the panhandle, you have a fourth. Now, what does that mean? For the one in Miami, you could have some big problems. I'll give you the latest on the Turkey Point facility and how it literally is in hot water over its cooling system and what you should know about it in case there's a storm surge, because you could be sitting on another Fukushima-style nuclear disaster. Some say it's inevitable in the Miami area, and I believe it should be made a public issue immediately. If you live in New York and you go to those parks, of which we have a lot of nice ones, well, you could be facing an increased risk of cancer, especially lymphoma, from Monsanto's Roundup. I'll give you the latest on that, because I'm sure you didn't read the article in a very important scientific publication that talked about that. But we do read those articles every day, scanning the world scientific literature, the independent literature. This is from the issue of the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, finding that Roundup's active ingredient, glyphosate, is associated with lymphoma. And that's what they're spraying in our parks? You bet. How often? Well, 1,300 times last year, according to the Parks Department. That's important that you know. And today I will be offering Bill O'Reilly, from his raving comments last night about how he's fully protective of the police in the United States and using statistics about how many tens of millions are arrested and there's only 400 plus deaths, and isn't that terrific? Depends upon where you're getting your statistics and what context you're using them. So for all of you who were watching O'Reilly last night, I will give you a broader, more honest interpretation of how bad it is with police misconduct. Not a few rotten apples. We have a lot to share. Plus, the second half of our program today will be part three, the final part, of Bill Moyer's outstanding documentary on the secret government. He did this in 1987-88. We've gotten very positive feedback from the listeners around the world. Remember, we're heard not just in the New York area. We're heard in 166 countries. We're the number one listened to progressive radio program in the world. And you need to hear this stuff. You need to hear Bill Moyers, because everything that he was exposing then is happening on steroids again today. Same mechanisms, same bureaucracies, in some cases the same cast of characters. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. For the African Americans in this audience, which is substantial, about 58% of our audience are African Americans, your number one reason that you die prematurely is because of heart disease and stroke, high blood pressure. More often than not, the majority have some form of imbalance in glucose metabolism. Generally, blood sugars are elevated because of poor diet, lack of exercise, obesity, and diabetes. It all goes together. That's why it's called metabolic syndrome. This is one way to help save a life. This is from Science Daily, and this was done at the Georgia Prevention Institute at Georgia Health Sciences University in Augusta, specifically for overweight African-American adults. Vitamin D can reduce heart risk and save lives. Quote, according to Dr. Ryan Harris, associate assistant professor, the Georgia team's research suggests that vitamin D supplementation cut the cardiovascular risk by improving the health and function of vascular endothelial cells, cells that line the inside of blood vessels. And this was shared at the Experimental Biology Conference. Quote, an article entitled Vitamin D Improves Flow-Mediated Dilation in African-American Adults. About 2,000 units a day, that's not a lot, but 2,000 units of vitamin D a day I would take by supplement, because here's the irony. In Caucasians, when you're using sunscreen, you're blocking vitamin D. In African Americans, the melanin in your skin helps substantially block the vitamin D. That's why supplementation is important. The U.S. meat and poultry, it's not clean. And let me just explain one of the reasons it's impossible, virtually, scientifically, hygienically impossible to ever have a clean piece of meat. Chicken, fish, sushi in the fish, beef, pork, not possible. Why? Because the moment the animal is killed, a massive surge of cortisol streaks through the body at the shock of death, locking in the blood inside the cells. The only blood that you're going to have drained out of an animal are in the veins and arteries, and that's a relatively small percentage of what's in the body. The vast majority of blood is in the actual tissue. And that's why people say they want their steaks blood rare. Well, think about this for a moment. Blood, when it's circulating and has antibodies in it, and more than 67 different forms of natural immune modulators, is able to be kept fairly clean. But any viruses and bacteria are also streaming throughout the body, about every 6 minutes or so, in the blood. That means it's also in the cells. So at death, everything that's toxic in the body stays in the cell, can't get it out. You can soak it in salt water, doesn't matter, doesn't get it out. I remember once when I was watching as a kid, as best as I can recall, the idea of having a prime-aged steak. But I had the advantage of being on a farm watching it, and they took it on a hook from one room that was room temperature and put it into a cold room around somewhere in the 30 degrees. And then they brought it back. And after a day in that warm room, it stunk to high heavens. The meat was kind of a very greasy feeling, because I remember going over as a kid and I wanted to touch it and see what it felt like, and it was real slimy. And it stunk to high heaven, that what they call the smell of death. And it was gray. Now just imagine you cut your finger. Immediately it's red, because there's a lot of oxygen in the heme, in the blood. But about 20 minutes later, the blood has already gone through a process of clotting. Fibroblast cells and other cells are starting to reweave the cut, and the oxidation has occurred, so it's now not red, it's purple, then brown. And then it dries, flakes off, or you wash it off. That's all meat. All meat will oxidize when exposed to the air, and that increases bacteria growth. If you want a medium to see bacteria proliferate, take any sample any sample of meat, look under it, under a microscope, now look at the blood, take it separately, and you'll see bacteria proliferating. You could even do the same thing by putting in a petri dish and watch it grow. So the idea that somehow you're going to eat a clean piece of meat simply is not possible. There's going to be all forms of bacteria and microorganisms on that. Now, you can cook it, and you can kill a lot of it, but some things you won't kill. For example, if you had the microbe that causes mad cow disease, you could take it up to 700 degrees, and you won't kill it. That's why people in some hospitals were infected, because they had autoclaved the equipment, but it still withstood that high temperature. And that's especially true for organs. This is the latest on this. This is from the Science Daily, and this is from the Translational Genomics Research Institute, published in the peer-reviewed journal Clinical Infectious Disease. Quote, drug-resistant strains of Staphylococcus aureus, by the way, that will kill you, and does. A bacteria linked to a wide range of human diseases are present in meat and poultry from U.S. grocery stores at unexpectedly high rates, according to a national study. Nearly half the meat and poultry sampled, 47%, were contaminated with S. aureus, and more than half of those, 52%, were resistant to at least three classes of antibiotics. That was the first national assessment of antibiotic-resistant Staphylococcus aureus in the U.S. food supply. And the DNA testing suggests that the food animals themselves were the major source of the contamination. And although staph should be killed with proper cooking, it still poses a risk to consumers through improper food handling and cross-contamination in the kitchen. Just think of how many times in a restaurant they're fast, they're loaded, the sous chef can't keep up, the major chef is having a hard time just plating everything, and you're supposed to have a dish out within 12 minutes if it's not a main entree, 22 minutes if it's an entree. And so someone puts a piece of raw meat on a table, and later someone cuts a tomato, an onion, garlic on that same tomato. You've contaminated anything that meat touches. So just be aware of that. That's one of the reasons you should be a vegetarian. Now, speaking about being a vegetarian, this is the latest from Diabetes Care, done at Loma Linda University. Vegetarians experience a 36% lower prevalence of metabolic syndrome than non-vegetarians. Now, we know that metabolic syndrome, this audience knows, that it's a precursor to heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. And metabolic syndrome happens when you have at least three of five total risk factors, like high blood pressure or low HDL cholesterol. HDL is actually the good cholesterol, so if it's low, bad. If you have a high glucose level, if you have elevated triglycerides, or if you have a large waist, and 25% of vegetarians have none of that, and then vegans are the healthiest of them all. Quote, in view of the high rate of metabolic syndrome in the United States and its deleterious health effects, we wanted to examine lifestyle patterns that could be effective in preventing and possibly treating this disorder. I was not sure if there would be a significant difference between vegetarians and non-vegetarians, and I was surprised by just how much the numbers contrast. It indicates that lifestyle factors such as diet can be important in the prevention of metabolic syndrome. By the way, they examined 700 adults randomly sampled, and then they compared that to 100,000 Seventh-day Adventists across the country. Now, what they haven't done anywhere that I'm aware of, they have never taken a group of healthy vegans and compared them to those that ate meat, those who are just vegetarian, and those unhealthy vegans, because probably half of all vegans or vegetarians are unhealthy. Young people who, for ethical reasons, and I appreciate that, don't want to see an animal suffer, but they'll go eat a pizza or pastas or white bread, As long as they're not eating meat on it, they think it's okay. Ethically, they're right. Nutritionally, they're dead wrong. I've met a lot of unhealthy vegans. But they thought if they were vegan, they'd be healthy. Not true. So no one, to my knowledge, has ever done the experiment on healthy vegans. My hope is to be able to do that study within the next 12 months. And finally, calorie restriction in older mice prevents birth defects in the offspring. This is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is our top scientific standard in America. This was done at Massachusetts General Hospital, and they found a highly protective effect of caloric restriction against damaged chromosomes that causes infertility. That's good. But they could have extended that in saying calorie restriction, meaning don't eat those dense calories. When you can eat all the salad you want, you can eat all the leafy vegetables you want, you can even eat starchy vegetables. But eat anything with dense calories with the idea that when you have more calories going into your body than what your body needs, you're going to gain weight and you're going to stress your chromosomes and you're going to shorten your telomeres that are on the end caps of chromosomes. Just visualize you have shoestrings, and on the end of each shoestring, you have a little cap that keeps it from fraying, so you can put it in and out of your holes in the shoes. Those are telomeres. And quite simply, telomere length determines how long your cell is going to live. Now, you have telomeres in the heart, in the brain, in the liver, in the kidneys, in the lungs, in the muscles. So you may not have aged them as much in one part of the body as another. It depends upon what you're doing this imbalancing. If you're drinking alcohol, you're going to prematurely age the liver and the kidney and the heart and the brain. If you're over-exercising, which a lot of Americans do, they don't understand there's a difference between exercising for optimal health and exercising because of some emotional factor that means that you're working out beyond what the body benefits and actually works against you. But you won't see it today. You'll see it in 20 years when your muscle cells are not 40 and you're 40 chronologically. Your muscle cells are 60 or 70. You literally can exercise yourself into premature aging. That's why you don't want to overdo it. But caloric restriction, when you bring back the calories in the diet to what you actually need, you live a longer life. When you eat the excess calories, like sitting down to a fast food meal, way more calories than what your body can process in that meal, you're shortening your life. And that's the takeaway message. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now we immediately go to our environmental segment in Miami. Pay attention. We have a lot of listeners down there, and we're broadcast on a radio station in Miami. Now, Miami has a lot going for it, in beauty and weather, wonderful people, but it's got one big elephant in the room. There could be a Fukushima-like nuclear meltdown event, and it's growing, with the most likely next disaster predicted if there is a high hurricane, meaning a high number like Category 3, 4, 5, that hits the Miami area. That's because the Turkey Point facility, 20 miles east of Homestead, and according to a NPR story, the Turkey Point facility was found to be, quote, in hot water over its cooling system, which caused federal regulators to be so concerned that they upped the nuclear plant's cooling system allowable temperature to exceed 100 degrees limit for 10 days, up to 103 degrees if necessary. The plant has come close to 100 degrees, which should mandate an immediate shutdown. But instead of exercising precaution, regulators simply increased their legal limit, causing environmental groups in nearby Biscayne National Park to express grave concern. And there's a story entitled "Nuclear Plant May Be in Hot Water Over Its Cooling System." And we have posted it on our blog, and you can go to blog.garynoll.com to read it. And here's why it's important. Because the Turkey Point facility has a canal-based cooling system. The technology is out of the dark ages. What happens if that system fails, as it appears to be doing now, will be the non-canal-based cooling backup system, which is diesel-based. Have they tested it? No. How much do they have in the way of fuel? Don't know. Normally it's a week to 4 weeks. These questions need to be asked and answered. But the most poignant question of all is a core infrastructure failure occurring and responsible for the insufficient cooling system the plant is experiencing? According to the original Miami New Times expose, the Turkey Point nuclear facility has serious infrastructure issues that make it an extreme risk for a radiation leakage event, or much worse, quote from their report. It's old. When Turkey Point went into operation in 1972, it was licensed for 40 years. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission recently, quote, rubber-stamped another 20 years, allowing the plant to operate until 2033. This is uncharted territory. They cannot dispute that those reactors may crack from being bombarded by high-level radiation. And the most concerned evidence was provided by Aaron Elizabeth, founder of HealthNut News, who reported documented earlier today that the closest radiation monitoring to the Turkey Point station far north was the highest in the country at 100. That's the highest in the entire United States, which is close to alert level, the highest perimeter, the only publicly supported real-time independent radiation monitoring. The site radiationnetwork.com has in their gradient of concern and would indicate some radioactive source above and beyond background radiation is responsible. So, we believe that something should be done. And last June, they were fined $70,000 for violations regarding Turkey Point's spent fuel pools. The negligence, quote, could have resulted in severe nuclear accident that could be a horrific disaster all by itself, said Saportio. So, just remember, if the citizens don't get concerned about this, if you live in the Miami area, get the facts, get a private, independent investigation, because if there should be a hurricane, you could end up, earthquake, you could end up with a Fukushima right there. Also, there's a new study, this is important, that the Parks Department in New York was responsible for spraying pesticides on green spaces more than 1,300 times last year. And that is concerning many because of the prevalent cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and breast cancer. That's according to recent studies. And the pesticides they used most often, even where children were at play, in order to eliminate weeds that house rats in New York, is Monsanto's Roundup, full of glyphosate carcinogens. And even though city posts warning signs 24 hours prior to spraying, the toxic chemicals in Roundup linger, and no one really knows for how long. They say that they spray in little-used areas in the park, but we all know that if you're doing any spraying, you have rain, you've got runoff. It can travel through parks, lakes, and soil, contaminating larger areas. And so be concerned. And this was an article in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. Dr. Philip Langren, a professor of pediatrics at Mount Sinai, called the study, quote, very authoritative and believes the city should hold its use of Roundup. It isn't just the kids he's worried about. Quote, any amount of exposure to a suspected chemical carcinogen is dangerous. More is worse. Okay, there we have it. Now, we're going to go directly to a woman who is concerned about misogyny, women bashing, racism in much of rap music and its lyrics and presentations and even performance. Here's what she has to say on it.
So I heard a song the other day that objectified women in every way. That doesn't narrow it down much, but it was pretty depraved. The feminists are probably still rolling in their graves that see it reduce people to parts, objects to be acquired, turn hearts and minds into mere things to be desired. And as parts of my body were assessed and sized, I thought, what a way to be dehumanized. And these artists seem to be playing a game of how many times they can call us the wrong name. Because I'm not a dime, those come a dozen. No, I'm really not interested in all your loving. I'm not your shorty, your hoe, your trick, your baby, lady, girl, or chick. I mean, can someone explain to me how this counts as music when you chant, you pant about windows and walls? Talk about a woman like she's a thing to be mauled. Oh, she's got a big booty, so you call her a big booty? If she had a big brain, would you call her at all? But it seems like I'm the only one appalled that music can make me feel so small. You may think they're just words. That doesn't give them immunity. Words start wars and break spirits. They're still used with impunity. Just imagine a young girl, smart, funny, well-rounded, walks into a club and finds herself surrounded by men acting like they've got something to collect. They're just listening to the words that tell them that she's an object, and her objections catch in her throat as she gets harassed unchecked, treated with disrespect. She's caught in the middle, and the lady doth protest too little. A few words have made her think she's brittle. Do you see where I'm going? It's not exactly a riddle. I'm saying, can we turn up the volume, but turn down the noise? Stop polluting the minds of our men and our boys with all the rude misogyny and bland homogeny of rhymes and beats so crude and obsolete, because our ears are bleeding from all these cowards. The time is ours. We are ready to devour lyrics that make us feel empowered. Yeah, I watched a video the other day of my girl, Beyonce. She was draped in feathers and furs and things, exaggerated makeup and big chunky rings. She was dancing in the desert, hair looking wild. And I thought to myself, what does this look like to a child? To see a woman belt about her power while thrusting her hips to and fro. How will she know she can wear the pants in the house when her idol doesn't wear them in a video? I mean, on so many levels, it makes me go ballistic that we've consented to be portrayed as animalistic. Because on one hand, you're exotic, you're fierce, do no wrong. On the other, you're a female dog in every song. I don't want to be serenaded to my individual parts unless you can look past the flesh and talk about hearts. I mean, does anyone even know that Beyonce's smart? Because if she was a boy, even just for a day, she wouldn't have to crawl on all fours to crawl up the charts or shed those fine furs to grace a few album covers. Does her husband have that problem? Apparently, he's got 99 others. And it sounds dramatic. Maybe my skin should be tougher. But consider the history of women of color, not valued as wives or sisters or mothers, but used by men as unwilling lovers. When you think of the slaves who were used like instruments, you realize that society is progressing by mere increments. Just imagine the bodies covered in raw welts and tell me it's okay when black women are dressed in animal pelts. All those women who paid with their bodies to survive, 200 years later are portrayed as sex crazed and deprived. Please forgive me if I think music needs to be revived. I mean, can we turn up the volume but turn down the noise, stop polluting the minds of our men and our boys with all the rude misogyny and bland homogeny of rhymes and beats so crude and obsolete, because our ears are bleeding from all these cowards. The time is ours. We are ready to devour lyrics that make us feel empowered. So I heard a song that caused me pain. The words were bordering inhumane, because I'm not accustomed to boys yelling at me. Never had to face boys telling me to smack that, shake that, beat that up. Those aren't the ideas of love with which I grew up. Maybe the whole concept is new to me, but then he started whispering what he'd do to me in a place where no one else could see, without even asking if I'd agree, and I really had to strain to hear. The words came fast and disappeared. They were drowned out by good music, I'm not gonna lie, because good beats are the noise behind which singers hide as they beat a woman up inside. It's easy to do once we've been dehumanized, and the devil's greatest aid is my greatest frustration. It's the most common appellation to sweep the nation, rhymes with witch, I'll leave it to your imagination. And you may think there's no correlation, but when a man loves a woman who won't love him back, what if his first instinct is to attack? He's got lyrics and blood pounding in his ears, and a helpless woman bases her worst fear. She's smacked, shaken, beaten, torn apart. Against all odds, his bite's as bad as his bark. He causes the kind of pain that leaves a mark, and before he leaves, he turns to say his parting word. It's on the tip of his tongue, comes out unslurred. Might have been left unsaid if it had been left unheard, but it's been so programmed he doesn't twitch. His mouth fills with venom, and he spits out, "Bitch." What can she do to ease her strife? Every song on the radio is a soundtrack to her life. So can we turn up the volume, but turn down the noise? Stop polluting the minds of our men and our boys with all the rude misogyny and bland homogeny of rhymes and beats so crude and obsolete, because our ears are bleeding from all these cowards. The time is ours. We are ready to devour lyrics that make us feel empowered. I know it's a steep mountain to climb. It might take a while, but until that time, I think I'd just rather spit my own rhymes.
That's something to think about. I'd like to see all the churches, the religious groups and social groups in this country boycott every rap song, every song, rap or not, that denigrates a race, a religion, or a gender. Take away the money and the fame from people who exploit, and they think it's cool. There's nothing cool about demeaning women. Now let's go over and hear what one of the most important voices in journalism, still an important voice, has to say. Bill Moyers, in a very important Part 3 documentary on the secret government, Today we have that same secret government that has become a fascistic government that is controlled by oligarchs that are too big, too rich, and too politically connected to prosecute.
They think that it was so simple that people are just like the pawn of a game, like a chess game, you know, that you can move them around anywhere you want. But you have to understand that human life is very different from, you know, playing with human lives is different from playing a game. Because a game, you know, once you lose, there's nothing at stake. But when you lose a person's life or devastate a whole country as they did to my country, then it's very important, you know.
Please.
During the hearings this summer, Oliver North repeated something we've heard often in the last 40 years from presidents and the president's men.
I want you to know lying does not come easy to me. I want you to know that it doesn't come easy to anybody. But I think we all had to weigh in the balance the difference between lives and lies.
But these memories suggest a different equation. The lives lost because we lie to ourselves and to others. Someone always pays for decisions made secretly in Washington. Looking at such pictures brings to mind the words of an old ally, a Vietnamese official who survived the fall of Saigon and escaped to America. Life and death issues for us, he says, were merely bargaining chips in the American pursuit of global policy. I played a minor role in the Kennedy administration and a much larger one for half the Johnson years. I saw the Peace Corps go forth one day and the Green Berets the next. Once I wrote a speech for LBJ which implied a striking coincidence between the president's wish and God's will. A wise older man from my past called to gently upbraid me. He reminded me that it's very important how we talk about God because there can be disastrous consequences to what we say. Just so. We've learned that presidents must be very careful talking about what they want this nation to do, because the United States can unhinge whole countries simply by shifting our weight. We suffered then the passion of the time that America's defense and security were at stake in Vietnam. But our obsession was the real threat. Vietnam pushed the Cold War morality to its extreme conclusion. Exorbitant means to accomplish limited ends. Anything goes. The wounds still run deep. There are 58,000 names on this wall. 58,000 men died in Vietnam. Their deaths, and all the deaths in Southeast Asia, the names not on this wall, raise painful questions about our secret government and our role in the world. Were we certain what we ask people to die for? The men who wrote our Constitution tried to make it hard to go to war. Human life was at stake, they knew. And the character of our republic. War should be soberly decided, publicly debated, and mutually determined by the people's representatives. It is the people, after all, who must fight, pay, and die once the choice is made. The Constitution was to protect them from dying for the wrong reasons. It was to protect them from killing for the wrong reasons.
I don't know. The public still don't want to understand what the hell really happened. But maybe one day they will. As far as Central America, I see the same damn thing happening there in Central America that happened in Vietnam.
Well, I think the country has learned very graphically that we better be really assured that if we're going to send our young men and women off to die like this, that it better really be in the interest of every citizen of this United States to sacrifice somebody like that so that we don't have more blood on this wall. Or other walls. And I think that we ask a lot of questions now that we didn't used to ask. We want to know why. And we'll hear Ollie North's analysis of what's happening with the Contras, and a lot of us say we want some more verification of that. We want to know just what are we involving ourselves in when we go to do that.
Looking back, it's stunning how easily the Cold War enticed us into surrendering popular control of government to the national security state. We've never come closer to bestowing absolute authority on the president. Setting up White House groups that secretly decide to fight dirty little wars is a direct assumption of the war powers expressly forbidden by the Constitution. Not since December 1941 has Congress declared war. Since then, we've had a police action in Korea, advisors in Vietnam, covert operations in Central America, peacekeeping in Lebanon and low-intensity conflicts going on right now from Angola to Cambodia. We've turned the war powers of the United States over to where we're never really sure who or what they're doing or what it costs or who is paying for it. The one thing we are sure of is that this largely secret global war, carried on with less and less accountability to democratic institutions, has become a way of life. And now we're faced with a question brand new in our history. Can we have the permanent warfare state and democracy too?
A shellfish toxin.
In 1975, as the war in Vietnam came to an end, Congress took its first public look at the secret government. Senator Frank Church chaired the Select Committee to Study Government Operations. The hearings opened the books on a string of lethal activities, from the use of electric pistols and poison pellets to mafia connections and drug experiments. And they gave us a detailed account of assassination plots against foreign leaders and the overthrowing of sovereign governments. We learned, for example, how the Nixon administration had waged a covert war against the government of Chile's president, Salvador Allende, who was ultimately overthrown by a military coup and assassinated.
Like Caesar peering into the colonies from distant Rome, Nixon said the choice of government by the Chileans was unacceptable to the President of the United States. The attitude in the White House seemed to be, if in the wake of Vietnam I can no longer send in the Marines, then I will send in the CIA.
But the secret government had also waged war on the American people. The hearings examined a long train of covert actions at home, from the bugging of Martin Luther King by the FBI under Kennedy and Johnson, to gross violations of the law and of civil liberties in the 1970s. They went under code names such as Chaos, Cable Splicer, Garden Plot, and Leprechaun. According to the hearings, the secret government had been given a license to reach all the way to every mailbox, every college campus, every telephone, and every home.
You start out breaking foreign laws, since most countries have laws against secretly overthrowing their governments, and then you end up breaking the law at home and coming to feel a contempt for the law, for your colleagues and associates, for the Congress and the public, and for the Constitution.
Morton Halperin worked for Henry Kissinger on the National Security Council in 1969. Critical of policies in Cambodia and Vietnam, he resigned. He later discovered his telephone had been bugged for 21 months. He is now the director of the Washington office of the American Civil Liberties Union.
What you have is a growing gap between the perceptions inside the executive branch about what threats are to our national security and the beliefs in the Congress and the public about the threats to national security. And that leads to secrecy. That is what drives the policy underground. That's what leads the president to rely more on covert operations, and what leads the president and his officials to lie to the public and lie to the Congress about the operation, precisely because they cannot get their way in public debate. They are driven to seek to circumvent the democratic process.
And the president ought not to be in a position, in my humble opinion, of having to go out and explain to the American people on a biweekly basis or any other kind that I, the president, am carrying out the following secret operations. It just can't be done.
It is said that the constitutional system of checks and balances has so prohibited the president, so hamstrung him, that he cannot effectively lead foreign policy, that he has to be resorting to clandestine, covert, secret.
Of course that is. He needs to do that only when he wants to subvert Congress. If Congress says don't do that, and the president says, but I really want to, the conclusion from that isn't that the president is right. It is that the president is considering being an outlaw.
It's been said that the secret realm of government is the deformed offspring of the modern presidency. Presidents take an oath to uphold the Constitution, but then they find the cumbersome sharing of power with Congress an obstacle and start looking for shortcuts to silence their critics and achieve their objectives.
And it goes back to the beginning. I mean, there is a famous letter which Madison wrote late in his life in which he said, perhaps it is a universal truth that the loss of liberty at home will be charged to dangers real or imagined from abroad. And that is the lesson of history.
Was the incentive so great or the prospect?
But we don't seem to learn the lessons of history. Just 14 years ago, another Senate committee listened to another string of witnesses. The names still trip off the tongue. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it.
The White House crimes known as Watergate.
Cover would be taken off of the telephone, and two of the wires connected with this.
Crimes against democracy. To harass opponents, the Nixon White House had set up a secret team called the Plumbers. They bugged phones, opened mail, and burglarized the president's critics. Senator Inouye read the Watergate Committee a secret White House memo containing the Nixon enemies list and how the Plumbers intended to punish them.
Stated a bit more bluntly, how we can use the available federal machinery to screw our political enemies.
In both the Watergate and Iran-Contra hearings, there was contempt for Congress.
I believe Congress set up the FBI to determine what was going on in this country, didn't it?
Among other things, Mr. Chairman.
It set up the CIA to determine what was going on in respect to foreign intelligence, didn't it?
Yes, sir. And a number of others.
But it didn't set up the Plumbers, did it?
Of course, the Congress doesn't do everything, Mr.
No,
Chairman.
But Congress is the only one that's got legislative power, and I don't know anything, any law that gave the president the power to set himself up what some people have called a secret police, namely the Plumbers.
What was the reason to withhold information from Congress when they inquired about it?
I simply didn't want any outside interference.
Now, the outside interference you're talking about was Congress. And I take it the reason they were inquiring was precisely so that they could fulfill with information their constitutional function to pass legislation one way or the other. Isn't that true?
Yes, I suppose that's true.
And that you regarded as outside interference.
There was contempt for the law.
If the president could authorize a covert break-in, and you don't know exactly where that power would be limited, you don't think it could include murder or other crimes beyond covert break-ins, do you?
Oh, I don't know where the line is, Senator.
During your discussions with Mr. Casey, Mr. McFarland, and Mr. Poindexter about the plan, did a question ever arise among you as to whether what was being proposed was legal?
Oh, no. I don't think it was. I mean, first of all, we operated from the premise that everything we did do was legal.
Well, I'll go back to the and there was contempt July for the truth.
Now, Mr. Mitchell, do you draw a distinction between not volunteering and lying?
Well, it depends entirely on the subject matter.
When you ask the direct question and you don't volunteer the direct answer, you might say you're not volunteering, but actually you're lying on those respects.
Well, I think we'd have to find out what the specifics are of what particular occasion and what case.
Could you explain to me the difference that you think there is between knowing that you've left a false impression or a wrong impression and lying, to use an old-fashioned term?
Yeah, I think lying, we really mean, a deliberate effort to mislead people to a deliberate effort to leave them with a misleading impression. What I hoped to do was to avoid the question and duck the question as I expected.
President Reagan's men did learn one thing from Watergate. Richard Nixon said it only last year. Just destroy all the tapes.
Where are these memoranda?
Which memoranda?
The memoranda that you sent up to Admiral Poindexter seeking the president's approval.
But I think I shredded most of that. Did I get them all? I'm not trying to be flippant. I'm just...
Well, that was going to be my very next question, Colonel North. Isn't it true that you shredded them?
I believe I did.
Do you think that what we've seen of the secret sale of arms to Iran and the private war in Nicaragua is on a par with what we saw at Watergate?
Oh, the substance of it is far above Watergate. You have the sale of armaments to terrorist groups, which can only foment more kidnapping and more terror and finance it. You have the doing of this by members of the armed forces, a very scary thing. You have the government, at part at least, put in motion doing things that Congress has forbidden, direct illegality. You have constitutional abuses that are enormous.
Watergate did drive Richard Nixon from office.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
The imperial presidency was down, but not out. Ronald Reagan ran in 1980 with a strong and clear message. The world was a hostile place and closing in on America. Russian troops were in Afghanistan, Sandinistas were in Nicaragua, and Americans were being held in Iran. President Reagan wanted to reinvigorate the CIA, and he chose a tough director to run it, his campaign manager, William Casey. They were ideological soulmates, true Cold Warriors on the offensive. In 7 years, Ronald Reagan approved over 50 major covert operations, more than any president since John F. Kennedy. Reagan and Casey set the agenda, but it was this man's job to carry it out. In Oliver North, they had their 007. North's primary mission was to keep the Contra war going, despite the congressional ban on aid. For 2 years, he masterminded a privately funded airlift to Honduras. According to some reports, criminal elements used the secret airlift to smuggle drugs back into the United States, with profits being used to buy more weapons for the Contras. Two congressional committees are investigating those reports.
Were there Contras who relied on the profits of narcotics in order to buy arms and to survive? Yes, I'm convinced of that.
Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts heads a foreign relations subcommittee.
Once you open up a clandestine network which has the ability to deliver weapons or other goods from this country, leaving airfields secretly, under the sanction of a, quote, covert operation, with public officials, DEA, customs, law enforcement, whatever, pulled back because of the covert sanctioning, you've opened the pipeline for nefarious types who are often involved in these kinds of activities to become the people who bring things back in.
Oliver North had been told the airlift was using questionable characters. Robert Owen, his contact man with the Contras, wrote from the field that some of the leaders were running drugs. In February of 86, Owen advised North that a resupply plane had been used for shipping drugs. In Owen's words, part of the crew had criminal records.
The second sentence says, "Nice group the boys choose." Who are the boys?
CIA.
So what happens is the President of the United States says, this is the national security, you must step back and let these people do their job, and therefore a lot of smugglers, drug traffickers, others go through the back door.
I don't think the President of the United States said specifically, look the other way to these things. I don't think the President of the United States knew these things were going on. But the President of the United States did encourage to such a degree the continuation of aid to the Contras. And it was so clear through Casey and Poindexter, et cetera, that this was going to please the president.
And there is more, about 15 minutes more, that you can watch and listen to. Now, just think of the last few comments there. There is a person questioning, on behalf of the American people, the legitimacy of this, the secrecy of this, arming, in effect, terrorist, John Kerry. And what exactly has John Kerry been doing, following in the footsteps of Hillary Clinton? Why do we have this ISIS group today, or the Islamic State? Because we trained them, we funded them, along with Saudi Arabia and England, in the war against Libya. Why do we need a war against Libya? Gaddafi was not a threat to the United States. We wanted the resources. We talked on this program how that would end up being a massive mess. It's a massive mess. And allowed for Al-Qaeda offshoots to be encouraged, funded, and they took over his arsenal. Then that became the next stepping stone into Syria. We did the same thing there, and now we're looking at the blowback. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program.